And that's what happens to them. And we know two of the patients in the ICU died that way. We also know from Dr. Khaled and many of the other physicians and staff members that are there that a missile struck one of the patient wards in the hospital and it instantly killed the person, injuring six others. And just like the World Health Organization mentioned that this hospital is not functioning, but there's pandemonium. It's total chaos. These patients, many of whom are either amputees or they have been injured or they're even just sick from some sort of bacterial infection, they're not able to move around and there is no staff to check on them or to give them the antibiotics that they need or to deliver the care. And so there is a true level of uncertainty taking place here. They are all at risk. I believe you mentioned how the WHO said that there are 20 who need urgent referral. If that doesn't happen in the next 2 to 3 days, those people will die. They will be killed in this process. And I think what we're seeing is an assault overall on the healthcare system. It's already devastated, and you're talking about the largest hospital in southern Gaza, one of two referral hospitals that remain in all of the Gaza Strip, and one that was able to handle multiple operating room cases at one time. And so it's not operable, it's not functioning, and that is absolutely devastating. It's a public health nightmare, and it's horrifying to think what will happen to all of the people who need care in the Gaza Strip for an already overwhelmed system.
Have you heard anything, Dr. Ahmoud, of Atef Al-Hout, the director of the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis? We're seeing tweets that he was abducted by the Israeli military.
Yeah, I know him. I mean, he is the director there. He was somebody that said that he was going to remain in the hospital as long as there were patients there, even back when I was there, and it was clear that there was an imminent siege that was going to take place. And the last that I saw was a picture of him speaking to an Israeli soldier. Nobody's heard from him since. Nobody knows what has happened to him. And again, this is very much part and parcel for what we've seen happen to healthcare workers and the healthcare system in Gaza. We know that the director of Shifa Hospital suffered a similar fate in terms of being abducted and detained and being subjected to torture and humiliation.
Can you talk about the reports of the patients who died? We have reports of 8 patients who died. We see Dr. Al-Ser, who filed these video reports, standing next to a dead patient. He said he died after the electricity was cut off.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, is when we are talking about a hospital system, we're talking about the largest hospital, you're going to have very sick patients because the assumption is that this hospital has the capabilities to be able to take care of those patients. And Nasser Hospital, if it's fully functional, is a phenomenal hospital with incredible physicians, Dr. Khaled being one of those physicians. We're talking about probably the best and brightest clinicians in all of the world. And I can say that I've witnessed that firsthand. When you are not able to deliver any sort of supplies or care to this hospital, when the electricity cuts off and these people are on ventilators or they can't get an X-ray or a CT scan, or you can't work a pump that can deliver antibiotics or fluid into an IV, we're putting them at risk. We're putting them at danger. But I think people need to also recognize we're causing an incredible amount of suffering to take place. You know, the ICU is on the 4th floor of the hospital at Nasser, as well as the operating rooms. They're all on the 4th floor. Dr. Khaled shared with us around 7 days ago that a operating room nurse was walking through the hallway and was hit by a sniper. And so he became one of the patients at Nasser Hospital. He needed to have emergency surgery. He needed to have a tube placed because his lung had collapsed from the sniper bullet that hit him. And he was walking on the 4th floor. I mean, that's where all of us stayed. That's where we slept when we were working at Nasser Hospital. And any of these patients, if you were to walk through any of the floors at Nasser Hospital, you'll see they're lined up all next to each other. There is no space. Before any sort of siege, Nasser Hospital was 300% over capacity. There were over 1,000 patients there, and there was not a single inch or space that you could walk without running into a patient. And so it's exceptionally dangerous to leave these patients unattended without medical staff being able to deliver the care that they need. It's very dangerous when you're not able to deliver supplies to restock the hospital. And then when you cut off electricity and then raid the hospital and you hear reports of gunfire in the hospital like we did take place at Nasser Hospital, it becomes a bloodbath. It's a massacre. And that's something that I think every single healthcare provider in the world should stand up against. I mean, that's not something that's acceptable. Hospitals cannot become targets. There has to be a different way to accomplish whatever military objective there is. These hospitals are lifelines regardless of what city they're in, but especially in Gaza and especially in Khan Yunis. A place like Nasser is the last place, is literally the last place of refuge, not just for patients and doctors, but for the many internally displaced people who thought that it would be safe there. And so when we're talking about electricity being cut off, or maybe there's shrapnel flying through the window, or any of these workers not being able to leave, it's not just an inconvenience, it's not just another incident. It is horrifying, and it becomes a bloodbath. It's very, very concerning of what's happened at Nasser Hospital, but it fits with what we've seen happen to all of the other hospitals in the Gaza Strip, and it started all the way in the north, and it seems to be heading towards the south. And that's something that should concern every single person who wants some sort of ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, who wants hostages to be released, and who wants the people of Gaza to get the desperately needed aid that they deserve and are in need of right now.
The significance of Dr. Ahmed Moghrabi leaving Nasser, who has stayed there all this time, the head of plastic surgery, but feeling at this point of the raid to protect his family, he had to go south to Rafah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the tragedy in all of this. This is what we're forcing healthcare workers to do. This is what is happening to the healthcare system. I mean, as a result of that, people will die. People will suffer. And we cannot expect these healthcare workers to just be subjected to this sort of violence. That doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. And just as an American doctor who works in the United States, I remember when Ukraine had hospitals that were targeted, that the American Medical Association came out very strongly and appropriately saying hospitals and healthcare workers can never be targeted. For some reason, that is not happening in the Gaza Strip. We're not hearing voices as loud. We're not hearing professional societies like the American Medical Association come out against that. And so that's what happens. You have people like Dr. Ahmed, whose patients totally depend on him, but he's at risk of death. He can be killed, and that's not an overreaction. It has happened. Over 300 healthcare workers have died. Your show, your program reported on him, the six-year-old who was stuck in Gaza City, who was talking for 3 hours to the dispatcher from the Palestinian Red Crescent. She was waiting for somebody to rescue her. And then when an ambulance with two paramedics were trying to reach her and were given the green light and coordinated with Israeli authorities, they were bombed and killed, and Hind was left to die. She had died. And this is just another chapter in the assault on the healthcare infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. And so every way you look at this, it's an absolute tragedy, and people will suffer as a result of this.
What has the American Medical Association said?
Nothing. I mean, nothing. And they're not the only ones. It's most of these professional societies, especially when it comes to the healthcare professions, have been silent on the Gaza Strip. And if you try to broach this subject, it's what we're being told is that this is a very politically charged and polarizing topic. I reject that totally. That's unacceptable. It's not political or polarizing when you're talking about children who are hungry, just like you reported early in the show. It is not political or polarizing when you're talking about being able to treat patients, people getting dialysis, making sure that somebody doesn't bleed to death. It's not political or polarizing when you're asking for antibiotics. We're just asking that hospitals not be targeted, that they not be bombed, and that doctors and nurses can provide for their patients without being worried that they may be killed or that they may be abducted or arrested or whatever it is. They should be able to practice with that sort of peace of mind. And it's really unfortunate that, especially here in the States, we don't have that sort of consensus. The entire international humanitarian community is in consensus. You need a ceasefire now. Hospitals need to be protected and functioning. The WHO says they want to be able to deliver supplies to Nasser Hospital. Why that sort of conversation is derailed in the United States is beyond me, but it's something that's no longer acceptable. And it's much too late now to come out and say something, so we need even stronger approaches now. We need efforts to deliver aid to the people of Gaza. One out of six children in the north of Gaza need immediate nutritional intervention. That just came out 2 days ago in a report by UNICEF. One out of six kids is starving, and we need to do something now. They need to be hospitalized so they can get the nutrition that they need. You'd think that that's not something that's very controversial, that any sort of organization anywhere in the world, regardless of the background or ethnicity or faith, should be able to call for that, should be able to say, kids don't need to go hungry.
I just checked. The American Public Health Association did urge President Biden and Congress to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza back in November, whether or not the American Medical Association did, which they didn't. I want to thank you, Dr. Thayer Ahmoud, emergency room physician who spent 3 weeks in Gaza volunteering at Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, which was raided by the Israeli military this weekend. Dr. Ahmoud is a board member for Med Global, which has an office in Gaza, is working with the World Health Organization. Next up to Russia. More than 400 people have been detained for publicly mourning the death of Alexei Navalny, who died in an Arctic prison Friday. We'll speak with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen, staff writer for The New Yorker. Their latest piece, The Death of Alexei Navalny, Putin's most formidable opponent. Stay with us.
Кидай гостями в мои стены, свои зерна в зараженную почву, на переломанных кустах клочья флагов, на перебитых фонарях обрывки петель, на обесцвеченных глазах мутные стекла, на обмороженной земле белые камни. Кидай свой бисер перед сдернутым рылом, кидай пустые кошельки на дорогу, кидай монеты в полосатые кепки, свои песни в распростертую пропасть, в моем углу засохший хлеб и тараканы, в моей дыре цветные краски и голос, в моей крови песок мешается с грязью, а на матрасе позапрошлые руки, я за дверями роют ямы для деревьев, стреляют детки из рогатки по кошкам.
Riga Song by the Russian poet and singer-songwriter Yanka Diaghileva. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Russia, where more than 400 people have been detained for publicly mourning the death of Alexei Navalny, who reportedly died in an Arctic prison on Friday. Navalny was 47 years old. He was the most prominent critic of Vladimir Putin in Russia. He was serving a 19-year sentence at the time of his death. President Biden and several other Western leaders directly blamed Putin for Navalny's death. Navalny's mother, who traveled to the Arctic town of Kharp in hopes of retrieving her son's body, was told by prison authorities Navalny died of sudden death syndrome, but his family has not yet been given access to his body to allow for an independent autopsy. Kiri Yarmish, a spokesperson for Navalny, spoke on Saturday.
Alexei was a symbol of hope and a symbol of courage for many Russian people, now they feel like this idea of hope abandoned them, but that's not true, and I'm sure that people will find strength to continue their fight, because this is what Alexei always wanted, and this is what he was telling everyone all the time, even from the prison.
Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Kayamar called for an international probe into Navalny's death.
Look, the international community need to react with the strongest way possible, but we know that actions have very little impact right now on Putin and on Russia. But still, silence is not an option. We must stand up, and the international political leaders around the world must make as strong a statement as possible. They must demand investigations. They must, in fact, investigate his unlawful death themselves. We must call on the United Nations to investigate that death, that unlawful death, that killing, in fact.
For more, we're joined by Masha Gessen, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, award-winning Russian-American journalist, author of numerous books, including most recently Surviving Autocracy. Masha's new piece for The New Yorker is headlined The Death of Alexei Navalny, Putin's Most Formidable Opponent. Masha, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you start off by just responding to Alexei Navalny's death, what you believe happened, and the protests that have been taking place, the vigils that have led to hundreds of arrests?
Well, I have no doubt, like many other people, that he was killed. It was very clear from the time he was arrested upon returning to Russia in January 2021 that he was going to be kept in prison until he died or Putin died. They kept piling on sentence after sentence. And as Yulia Navalny, who spoke 2 hours ago, Yulia Navalny is Navalny's widow, as she pointed out, he wasn't just kept in prison. He was continuously tortured. He was kept in solitary. He was kept in this tiny concrete room with no place to sit or lie down except during allotted hours of sleep, with one book and one mug of water. He was starved continuously for more than 3 years. And yet he was unbreakable. He kept being funny. He kept being defiant. And finally, they killed him, which is absolutely devastating, despite being the expected outcome, I think, for all of us who have been following Navalny for many years.
Now, can you talk about what happened a few years ago when Navalny was poisoned, did not die? It was believed it was Novichok. His family got him out of Russia to Germany, and then his astonishing return to Russia. Talk about what happened then.
Yeah, let me be very clear. It's not believed that it was Novichok, a chemical weapon. It has been definitively established that it's Novichok, a chemical weapon developed illegally by Russia for chemical warfare, was used to try to assassinate Navalny. So in August 2020, he was flying from one Russian city back to Moscow and was started dying on the plane. The plan, clearly, by his assassins was that he was going to die on the plane because the poison was going to do its irreversible job while the plane was in the air. But then a series of almost miraculous things happened. The pilot decided to make an emergency landing in the city of Omsk. When the plane landed, an ambulance was already there and administered essential first aid. It didn't bring Navalny back to life. He was in a coma for 6 weeks. But the third thing that happened was that Yulia Navalny flew to Omsk and managed to pry Navalny out of the hands of a medical establishment, the Russian medical establishment, that would have killed him, and bring him to Germany for treatment and rehabilitation. German doctors who received him already had experience treating Russian political activists who had been victims of poisoning, and so they knew what they were doing. And that combination of factors, something that the assassins clearly could not have planned on, saved Navalny. After about 6 weeks in a coma, he came out, and he teamed up with the Bulgarian investigative journalist Christo Grozev, who was at the time working for Bellingcat. And together they were able to track down the actual people who poisoned Navalny. They figured out that he had been followed for at least 2 years by a team of 8 FSB agents, some of whom also happened to be chemists, that they would follow him to every town that he traveled to, until apparently they found the right moment to apply Novichok to the underwear in his suitcase, which he then put on before flying that day that he was poisoned. And in an incredible performance, Navalny ended up calling one of his assassins. He tried several, but one of them picked up and continued speaking, thinking that he was speaking to some bureaucrat representing the head of the FSB. And he confirmed Navalny's and Grozev's hypothesis about what had happened. He added some detail about how they had tried to kill Navalny and how they had tried to cover up their tracks. And in December 2020, Navalny released a made-for-YouTube movie called titled "I Called My Killer and He Confessed." A month after that, Navalny returned to Moscow, knowing full well that he was going back to a country where the president had ordered him killed. I think that there were a few things going on. One was that he just could not imagine himself staying in exile and becoming politically relevant. Another, I think, maybe he believed that by exposing the plot to kill him, he had somehow embarrassed him. I think he thought too highly of them. And I think the third thing that was happening is that perhaps he thought that the protests that would follow his arrest would be so massive that Putin would have to back down and release him. It wasn't an unfounded thought, because the protests were indeed massive. Russians demonstrated for weeks after Navalny was arrested on January 21st, 2021. But it wasn't enough to make Putin back down. Putin was determined to see Navalny die in prison.
I wanted to go to a piece that you wrote, Masha, 3 years ago, The Evolution of Alexei Navalny's Nationalism. You say, on the one hand, you thought that he was an extraordinarily brave, inventive, and committed opponent of Vladimir Putin's regime. On the other hand, he'd allied himself with ultranationalists and expressed views that I found extremely objectionable and potentially dangerous. And in a few paragraphs later, you talk about a movement he helped to start in 2007, for which he released a YouTube video, one a 40-second argument for gun rights, the other a minute-long feature Navalny dressed as a dentist presenting a slightly confusing parable that likened interethnic conflict in Russia to cavities and argued that fascism can be prevented only by deporting migrants from Russia. You said Navalny closed his monologue with, "We have a right to be ethnic Russians in Russia, and we will defend this right." It's decidedly disturbing to view, you wrote. And you said around the time Navalny released the video, and for a couple years after, Navalny took part in the Russian March, an annual demonstration in Moscow that draws ultra-nationalists, including some who adopt swastika-like symbols. Can you talk about this? Talk about his whole evolution. He died at the age of 47.
I'm glad you're asking me about this, because the Kremlin has been incredibly effective at wielding these accusations of ethno-nationalism against Navalny and discrediting him among a lot of people, among a lot of leftists in the West, for one thing. And when I wrote this piece 3 years ago, this was after he was arrested, I did a lot of research that I say in the piece I should have done earlier. I knew Navalny. We were never close friends, but we were acquaintances, and we certainly had many conversations about the protest movement over many years. And I would see him when I went to Moscow, when I still could go to Moscow. And I covered his movement, his anti-corruption movement, but I never really had sat down and talked to him about those early videos and the evolution of his own political views. So I had to reconstruct them after he had been arrested. And what I found was that he really had moved as far away from his early political views as I think a person can. He came into activism in Russia, and I think this context is important, at a time when Putin had already succeeded in destroying the public sphere. It seemed that there were very, very few people opposed to Putin. And the discontent that I think he was trying to tap into, and that he was also a part of, was a kind of xenophobic discontent. So his early political views were anti-migrant and libertarian. And by the time of his death, and really by the time of his arrest and earlier, his biggest concern was not even so much with corruption as with social welfare. And his views, he had evolved from an ethno-nationalist to civic nationalist. I think this is a distinction that Americans are not quite aware of. But it is an important distinction. It's not the focus of it is on national liberation and the civic pride, participation in politics, enfranchisement, and not at all the early views of ethno-nationalism and anti-migrant. I do wish that he had been more explicit about denouncing his early views. He did apologize for those early videos, but he never apologized for taking part in the Russian marches, as I understand it, because he was afraid of alienating part of his base. But I'm quite certain that his own views and his own priorities lay very, very far away from those early views.
And let's talk about where he went today. Apparently, in one of his last tweets, Navalny argued Russia was discriminating against Muslims by refusing to allow them to have Qurans in prison, saying, Russia found a new enemy in Muslims. I can have a Bible, but a Muslim can't have a Quran, Masha.
That's a great example, actually, of how his views had evolved. And from what I understand, the way that he came to try to advocate for prisoners' rights, particularly for Muslim prisoners' rights, was that he had asked for a Quran himself. He had he was an inveterate reader. I mean, he was really an autodidact. His formal education in Russia was not great. He spent several months at Yale as a World Fellow, which I think was a huge sort of step forward in his political evolution. This was way back in 2010 or 2009, and once he was in prison, he wanted to understand more about religion. He said that this was something that was entirely foreign to him. He was a hyper-rational being, and he kind of envied his friends who had faith. So he decided to read great religious texts. And when he asked for the Quran, he found out that this was not something that prisoners were allowed to have. And that led him to advocate for the rights of Muslim prisoners.
This is Alexei Navalny's wife, Yulia, speaking at the Munich Security Conference on Friday. It was just after she learned that her husband may well have been killed.
I want Putin and all of his entourage, Putin's friends and his government to know that they will be held accountable for what they have done to our country, to my family and to my husband, and that day will come very soon.
Do you have that same kind of confidence, Masha? You've written that the death of Navalny doesn't indicate the strength, the weakness of Putin, but his strength. We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah. I don't have that same kind of confidence, but I admire Yulia Navalny's confidence. And 2 hours ago, she actually made another address, and she said she's going to be stepping into Navalny's shoes, and I think she's going to lead the movement that he founded. It was an extraordinary address, and I recommend that every viewer search for it on YouTube when the show is over.
And the significance of his mother going to the penal colony, 15 seconds.
The mother went to the penal colony hoping to pick up Navalny's body. The body has not been released, most likely because the body bears the traces of whatever was used to kill him.
Masha Gessen, we want to thank you for being with us, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, award-winning Russian-American journalist, author of numerous books, including most recently, Surviving Autocracy. That does it for our show. We'll link to your latest piece on Alexei Navalny. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Something curious, something cultural. Something unserious? Sometimes serious. Something mundane? Something everyday? Though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.